Hey, future doctors. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Spoonful Sugar, a podcast made for medical students by medical students to help medicine go down. My name is Trent Henderson, and I'm a student at Des Moines University, and I'll be your host today. So, today, we'll be covering lipids. In the previous episode, we covered how we process them from start to finish, what apolipoproteins are used, and examples of apolipoproteins. Today, we are covering familial dyslipidemias and hyperlipidemics to keep them in check. We'll be asking lots of questions and integrating a few different systems while talking about lipids. While we include many details that you would find in study resources, our goal this episode is meant as a way to practice some of the high yield concepts and terms and get exposure to them in a Q&A format. So don't get disheartened if you don't know all of these. It's just practice. Without further ado, let's get started with the clinical vignette. A 75-year-old woman arrives at the emergency department with a mild epigastric discomfort, dyspnea, and light diaphoresis. After ordering a 12-lead ECG and cardiac enzymes, you see a 2 mm ST elevation in lanes V2 to V5 and an elevated high-sensitivity troponin. Our labs today show an LDL of 190, HDL of 35, and triglyceride levels of 215. After diagnosing her with a STEMI, she asks you what possibly could have led to this. So, how would these labs be connected to this myocardial infarction and other conditions? Let's take a while to think about that and start with familial dyslipidemias. All right, so familial dyslipidemias are generally 4, potentially 5 types. We're going to cover 4 today, starting with type 1. So type 1 is an autosomal recessive disease, and it's also called hyperchylomicronemia. So too many chylomicrons. Does anybody remember what this would be related to or why this might happen? I'll give you a second. It might be a challenging one. Okay, so yeah, so chylomicrons are going to transport from the enterocytes to the liver. They're going to be transporting triglycerides, cholesterol, basically everything from the GI system. And they're going to be doing this via lipoprotein lipase or ApoC2. So this is important to remember. So remember, lipoprotein lipase is going to break down some of these, and so basically you're going to be able to digest them. And then C2 is for cuts and cleaves, 2 C's. So basically, if you're not going to be able to break these down because of a deficiency in lipoprotein lipase or ApoC2, that's going to cause issues with all these building up circulating chylomicrons. You're not going to be able to cleave them effectively, and so they're going to build up, not be used, and you're going to have really high triglycerides. They could potentially lead to even other conditions. Do you know a potential condition that this would be associated with? It is a GI system organ. It could be associated with pancreatitis if the levels get high enough. Generally, they have to be probably near 1,000, 900, but that is something to look out for. So there are some other conditions too. Another could potentially be pretty superficial. That could be related to high triglycerides. Do you know what that might be? Okay, so if you're thinking xanthomas, that would be correct. Interestingly enough, getting back to just the hyperchylomicronemia type 1, so it does increase your triglycerides, but it does not increase your risk of atherosclerosis. So you're not going to be seeing all these cardiac, complaints. You're going to see maybe the pancreatitis. You might also see it on a blood draw. If you take this blood sample, you centrifuge it or leave it out, you might get a very creamy supernatant layer on top just because it's so lipid rich and has so little density that the one layer will start to rise pretty significantly. So a good way to remember this one is hyperchylomicronemia, and kind of within there at the end of it, the micronemia, there's a one in the word. So if you see this on a test question, remember, look for the one, and that is our type 1 autosomal recessive hyperchylomicronemia. Okay, that was a lot. Let's move on to type 2. Type 2 is very different, pretty much everything. So type 2A is going to be an autosomal dominant condition. It's also known as hypercholesterolemia. And this one is due to an absent or defective LDL receptor. So again, an absent or defective LDL receptor. Notice that there are 2 L's in that name. Okay, so this one's important because the number of LDL receptors impacts how much circulating LDL will be taken up. So what do you think is going to happen if you have defective LDL receptors? Is the amount of LDL going to go up or is it going to go down, like in circulation? Okay, so it's going to go up because it's not being taken up by the liver. So if you have a single copy of this, remember I said it's autosomal dominant, how high would it get? Do you know? So it could get up to, maybe 300 mg per deciliter, which is high. And it's also relatively common too. It's about in about 1 in 250, 1 in 300 people. So, theoretically, this can also be homozygous. Of course, it'd be a little more rare. But if you have two copies, your cholesterol levels could get up to over 700. This can be associated with significantly increased rates of atherosclerotic complications such as MI. It's going to happen really early, too. This is going to be like the case of, like, 25-year-old that has an MI. There's going to be probably something going on pathophys-wise. So to look out for this one, you're gonna kind of look out for some of the similar things. You remember the skin condition, xanthomas. Those you can see with this one. You can also see some corneal arcus. Do you know what that looks like? So it's kind of a white, gray, bluish ring around the peripheral edge of the cornea. It looks like just kind of like around the edge is the color. You'll see it. It's a pretty distinct finding. I think it's a little more common in elderly, but if someone has this, you may see it earlier. And again, way to remember this. Two L's in LDL for type 2A. So, of course, if I say type 2A, there's a type 2B. Type 2B is very similar to type 2A, but it has an increased cholesterol or LDL, but also increased VLDL. So, it's basically the same. 2A, 2B is like 2A, but you add VLDL on. Okay. Okay, so next we have type 3. This one's autosomal recessive, and it's also known as dysbeta-lipoproteinemia, not to be confused with A-beta-lipoproteinemia. Again, the dysbeta-lipoproteinemia is kind of like dysfunction, and the A-beta-lipoproteinemia is kind of a lack of. Remember that was one from the last episode. It's basically like a GI issue, getting it out of the enterocytes. So this one's a little different. This one is a defect in APOE function. So remember what APOE does? Kind of remember one easy way to remember it. So it's APOE, you say it long. So it mediates remnant uptake. APOE is present on most lipoprotein particles like chylomicron remnants, VLDL, IDL, and HDL, but notably not LDL. So it mediates hepatic remnant uptake for everything except LDL. So an issue with uptake will lead to increased presence of apolipoprotein remnants in circulation. So what do you think you might see with that? If basically everything is like increased, so like your VLDL, IDL, all these things are going to turn into LDL, they're all increased because they're not being taken up. And so because of this, you're going to see increased atherosclerosis as well as cholesterol, triglycerides. So an easy way to remember this one, again, the dysbeta-lipoproteinemia is it is type 3. Is APOE and remnant uptake. So 3 is E, 3 is APOE. That's the issue there. Okay, so type 4. Type 4 is autosomal dominant. It's also known as hypertriglyceridemia. This is caused by hepatic overproduction of VLDL. So too much production of these very low density lipoproteins. Thus, if we have an increased levels of VLDL, remember what they're full of? Triglycerides, they're very rich, they're huge, they have so much fat in them compared to the cholesterol. And so these type 4 is going to raise your triglycerides up to like 2,500, and it's going to increase your risk of pancreatitis. Normally it doesn't get up to 1,000 with this one, but it could. And with the next type 2, type 5, it can get even higher, but it's a little bit less boards relevant. So just to kind of bring this one back, this type 4, which one of the others does this resemble? If you have these like high triglyceride levels. Okay, so this one is like type 1 because it increases your risk of pancreatitis. So a little way to remember this, type 4 has four letters, right? So 4, think VLDL, that's the only one with four letters. Additionally, if you do Roman numerals, type 4, it has a V in it, so VLDL. Should help you remember it. There are a couple different ways. So type 4 for four letters, big one, VLDL. So now that we've gone over those, kind of flew through them, let's just go over their inheritance patterns again. So there's an easy way to remember this. You don't need to, rote memorize it. There's a pattern. So I like to remember these as 2 and 4. You'll see more since they're autosomal dominant. And then 1 and 3, leave them be since they're autosomal recessive. So again, 2 and 4, you'll see more. Those are autosomal dominant. And then just kind of remember that the rest are autosomal recessive, just like other genetic conditions. Remember the autosomal dominant ones are X-linked. Okay, so moving on. Now we are done with our familial dyslipidemias, and we want to go to some of the physical signs of these diseases. So let's say you come see a patient, and on physical exam, we see some smooth, firm nodules over the calcaneal tendons bilaterally. They're yellow, a little uncomfortable. What would you call these? So these are tendinous xanthomas. They form lipoproteins, or they're from lipoproteins that have extravasated from the plasma and accumulate in tendons with these very high lipid levels. So you got a kind of this baseline high like serum levels. And then on histology, you want to look at this if you were to, and you would see foam cells or Teuton giant cells. And so that's kind of unique to that. So type 1 is going to be associated with eruptive xanthomas. Type 2 is going to be associated with some of the more calcaneal extensor tendons. I like to remember that one because you generally have two of them, two sides, like two heels, two Achilles heels, two arms, and then you also have two eyes. So this is a corneal arcus one. May not be present, but it could be. Next, we have type 3. That one's going to be associated with tubero-eruptive and palmar xanthomas. So kind of unique. Tubero-eruptive, they're going to stick out a little more, and you get the hand ones. Okay, so you could get these in another condition as well, some of these xanthomas. Do you know what that might be? Something to look out for? It's a little bit kind of related. But the thing we're talking about, if you can read my mind, is primary biliary cholangitis. So if you see xanthomas, don't always think one of these familial dyslipidemias. Think, maybe it's PBC. Okay, so let's say you were to see these, kind of like yellow, slightly painful nodules, and they were on the medial sides of the palpebral fissures, the eyelids. What would that be called? Okay, so that'd be xanthelasma. So, what is a tendinous xanthoma, and where does it most commonly occur? So, kind of in the name, a tendinous xanthoma is a lipid deposit within a tendon, commonly affecting the Achilles tendon and finger extensor tendons. So, think type 2. All right, so last, what is the name for the lipid deposit appearing as a ring around the cornea? Corneal arcus, type 2. Okay, so moving on to another condition, cholesterol emboli. When is this going to happen? What makes you think cholesterol emboli? Kind of a hard question, no context. But what you're going to be looking out for is a recent invasive vascular procedure, such as angiography, angioplasty, endovascular grafting, anytime they're going in with like a catheter or something where there's potential for like endovascular damage. You could basically knock something off, and these cholesterol are going to embolize because they're already in there, Let's say they've had like high LDL, low HDL for years, and then they go in, of course, because there's been an MI, whatever's going on, and these can be released. So, what it is basically by definition, it's microembolization of cholesterol crystals that break off from atherosclerotic plaques, usually in large arteries like the aorta. These tiny emboli, they travel to small arteries, causing end organ damage. So think they go from big to small. You're breaking them off on a macro scale, and then they just embolize. They get really small into these crystals. And so they're going to go to all of the different organs and affect things differently. So the things you're going to have to look out for, you could look for skin changes. You could have like livedo reticularis. It's going to be like a mottled, net-like skin discoloration, kind of blue. So look out for the skin. Look out for the toes. Think about, how much distance there is between from the aorta to toes. Those emboli could get really small, and they could start to clot things off, like digital, digits, and it could lead to blue toe syndrome. That's a pretty classic test question. Next, they could go to the kidneys because, again, they have very small vasculature. And so what that could lead to is like an AKI, acute renal failure. Could have some issues there. Suddenly become like anuric, oliguric. Got to look out for that. Next, we have cerebral vascular accidents because, again, they could go up, kind of depending on the vasculature. You could also have some intestinal ischemia from this embolization. So if you were thinking about this and it was on your differential, would you look for pulses? Let's say you did. What would you see? Okay, so you'd actually probably find normal pulses because the larger and medium-sized arteries are going to be unaffected. Problem is the very much the small artery emboli, kind of these more distal features. Okay, so I kind of mentioned it, but a risk factor for cholesterol emboli is atherosclerosis. And what is atherosclerosis? I'll give you a second. Okay, so it's a very common disease of elastic arteries and large and medium-sized muscular arteries. Basically, it's a type of arteriosclerosis caused by cholesterol plaque buildup in the tunica intima of the vessel wall. So it's basically just like cholesterol plaque buildup. It's kind of complicated. We'll talk about it a little bit in the upcoming minutes. But where are you going to find it most often? There's kind of a way to think about it, or a little saying. And it goes, a copycat named Willis, if you've heard of that, in the study resources. So basically think A for abdominal aorta. That's probably the most common. Number two, copycat. So copy for coronary arteries. think if the heart is affected, that's gonna be pretty serious. If you see, potentially the abdominal aorta, think, hey, that's most common. Think, maybe there's a heart issue as well. So next is the PCAT, CAT for popliteal arteries. So that'll be behind the knees. And then next we have CAT for carotid arteries up in the neck. And then last we have the circle of Willis. And so rounds out our copycat named Willis. Basically, these are some of the most common. And so if you're worried about, maybe carotid arteries, you could look at the popliteal. Just kind of look. If you see one, you might see others. Okay, so what are some risk factors for atherosclerosis? Let's start with non-modifiable. Okay, so if you're thinking things like age, male sex, postmenopausal status, family history, those would be great. Those are risk factors, but we can't change them. So what can we change? Like, what could you, help somebody manage? So number one, hypertension, so high blood pressure, that is a risk factor for atherosclerosis. Number two, tobacco smoking, risk factor for many things, but also for atherosclerosis. So if they have issues, they might need to stop smoking. Number three, dyslipidemia. The whole point of these episodes, basically increased LDL, decreased HDL. Again, you want that ratio. The LDL, it's depositing. HDL, it's bringing it back. And so if you have a lot of depositing and then not much bringing it, nothing bringing it back, that's going to be an issue because you're going to get, kind of this lay down. It's going to form a foundation for atherosclerosis. Next, you're going to have diabetes, and this can affect kind of macro, microvasculature as well. Think about kind of like a sugary, sticky, it can start some like complex or relatively simple even chemical reactions within the vasculature. Okay, so let's say you do have atherosclerosis. What's it going to look like? What symptoms are going to happen? This might be kind of a trick question because often it's asymptomatic for many years. Because basically the diameter of these arteries is sufficient, it's able to make do with what it has. But then when it becomes narrow to a certain point, or is an acute thrombus, occlusion, that may be very problematic. You may feel it very quickly. And so it could be a quick onset claudication, or it could be, slow over time, like when you start walking long distances. It could also be like chest pain. It could be like more of a stable angina, such as when you go upstairs, versus, acute, like all of a sudden, like you get a MI, just because of like a occlusive thromboembolism. So next, we kind of want to talk about a little bit about how does this occur. I've talked about where it is, kind of what it is, what symptoms look like, but what is actually happening behind this here? What's kind of like the path of phys? So first, it kind of starts with endothelial dysfunction. Again, this is kind of like the inner lining of the vasculature. And basically, we want some sort of disruption. We want something to go wrong with this process. So think about high blood pressure. It's going to be exerting extra pressure on these arteries, sometimes significantly. Also, if we have a turbulence, like if we have different types of flow, it's not even, it's not laminar. And so atherosclerosis will cause that. It'll cause turbulences, some that are already going to exist near like bifurcations. Those are great points where atherosclerosis is going to build up and you'll get a lot of turbulence. Additionally, if you have kind of an irritant, such as like smoke from smoking, that will do it as well. So next, basically, this irritant or dysfunction is going to allow oxidized LDL to enter the intima. So again, this is our low-density lipoprotein. It's going to enter kind of the inner vasculature, the inner layer, and then the macrophages are going to ingest it, because it's kind of an issue. It's an oxidized LDL. They're going to form foam cells, and these foam cells are going to cluster up. They're going to, join, aggregate, and they're going to form fatty streaks. And these are the earliest visible lesions of atherosclerosis. Okay, but the story doesn't end there. Next, you're going to get some factors, maybe like platelet-derived growth factor, PDGF, and that's going to stimulate your smooth muscles to migrate into the intima. So basically, you're going to get some smooth muscle. It's going to kind of migrate, come inwards. That's going to perforate, that's going to grow, and that's going to secrete an extracellular matrix. So basically, outside of these cells, it's going to keep building inside the lumen. It's basically going to build a fibrous cap over this lipid-rich core. So basically, think about it. You've kind of got this like fatty interior. I mean, think about almost maybe not a lipoma, that's not the right way to put it, but like there's basically going to be a soft inside and then it's going to cover, it's going to cap it. And you're going to get this fibrous plaque. It might calcify even just because it's there all the time. And depending on the pattern of calcification, some plaques are really likely to rupture. Some are less likely to. It's kind of probably beyond the scope of this episode, but that is a factor. Next, we can have some inflammation and enzyme activity, like matrix metalloproteases. They can weaken this cap, and so kind of that protective layer, and that can increase the risk of plaque rupture, thrombosis, and downstream ischemia. Very problematic. Okay, so what are some potential other complications of atherosclerosis? We talked about some of the risk factors, kind of the pathogenesis, but other things that can happen are aneurysms. We get some of the weakening of the vessel wall, and so you got to watch out for like things like AAA, like the abdominal aortic aneurysm. Next, we could have like ischemia, which would be like reduced blood flow, so like angina, claudication. This can be really painful. Third, we could have infarctions due to like a more of acute vessel occlusion, so like MI, ischemic stroke, mesenteric ischemia, so like GI. Next, we could have peripheral arterial disease, could be chronic limb ischemia from large vessel atherosclerosis. Next, thrombosis from plaque rupture and acute clot formation. And then last, we have thromboembolism. So embolism, basically these are going to be the ones that will break off and then they'll travel downstream to wherever they land and cause problems. Okay, so what are we going to do about that? We've got all these problems potentially with some of our lipids, and that's why we have lipid-lowering agents, antihyperlipidemics. Okay, so what is the lipid-lowering agent or drug? So if you were thinking of the HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors or statins, that would be correct. But before we start describing statins, I have a question. So is most of the cholesterol in the body that we have, it's an important, compound with cell membranes, steroid hormones, and so is this going to be mostly produced endogenously, or is it going to be mostly consumed in a diet? Give you a second to think about that. It's kind of interesting because it can be consumed in the diet, but it's mostly produced endogenously. So, okay, so most of it's produced endogenously, so that makes sense that we could modify it. So how do these work? So HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors are basically inhibiting the rate-limiting step of cholesterol synthesis. This creates less cholesterol, of course, but it also has a second effect too. And so that second effect is it's going to lead to upregulation of LDL receptors on hepatocytes. So basically, the liver is going to try to uptake more LDL. And that's a good thing because it's going to decrease it in your vasculature where it could lead to issues. So I'm going to ask it again. So, what would an increased amount of LDL receptors on the liver do? This is really important. So it's going to decrease the serum LDL cholesterol levels, triglycerides, while also raising HDL. Okay, so now you see why it's so effective. And clinical trials show the same thing. It is very effective, much more so than the other compounds. But it could potentially come with side effects, and do you know what those might be? Okay, so if you're thinking myalgias, mild GI discomfort, or headache, with a very small potential of rhabdomyolysis or hepatotoxicity, that would be correct. However, I will say there is kind of a common potentially misperception of side effects and like the prevalence of it. This is something that's been spoken about by like the American Heart Association. Quick dose statement from them. Trials have shown the risk of statin-induced serious muscle injury, including rhabdomyolysis, is less than 0.1%, and the risk of serious hepatotoxicity is 0.001%. And so I've heard that they used to serial test for, the LFTs, transaminases, but now they just do it at the start since it is so rare. So, despite that, in US clinical practices, roughly 10% of patients stop taking a statin because of subjective complaints. Many commonly report muscle symptoms without raised creatine kinase. But at the same time, and kind of in contrast, randomized clinical trials show a difference in incidence of muscle symptoms without significantly raised creatine kinase in statin-treated compared to placebo-treated participants as less than 1%. So they're basically the same. And it's an even smaller difference for patients who discontinue treatment because of such muscle symptoms. So what this suggests is that muscle symptoms are usually not caused by pharmacological effects of the statin, and it's possibly a nocebo effect. So just something to consider. There are ways to adjust. You can reduce the doses. Many clinicians start with like a higher dose, and so there's leeway to reduce that or try other statins. So kind of moving on. Next, for our step two, level two recommendations, basically keep this in mind, especially if you're taking those. What are our two high intensity statins, and what are the dosages? Okay, so if you're thinking of atorvastatin, maybe 40 to 80 mgs, that is a high intensity statin, or rosuvastatin, 20 to 40 mgs, that is high intensity, and these are meant to lower your LDL by 50% or greater. That is the goal. So, who's going to get a statin? Who should you prescribe these to? Who's at risk? Who's going to benefit the most? And who would have a smaller amount of benefit? So, from the USPSTF, as of 2022, they are making recommendations for primary prevention. And this is basically going to be before MIs, just kind of like people with risk factors. And so, the first one is people, adults aged 40 to 75. So that is a 35-year window with one or more risk factors, such as dyslipidemia, such as the conditions we've talked about, high LDL, low HDL, high triglycerides. If they have diabetes, hypertension, or if they smoke, plus a 10-year cardiovascular disease risk of greater than 10%, then you should initiate a statin. And that's a grade B recommendation. So basically, just to make it easy, if they're like a middle-aged to older adult, they have like a risk factor like diabetes or they smoke, and then they have a they're going to give you this number. They're not going to expect you to calculate on an exam, but basically a greater than 10% 10-year cardiovascular disease risk, start a statin. That's going to be your number one. Okay, so another potential risk category. It's a little bit less potentially efficacious is the same group, age 40 to 75, plus one of those risk factors. But the one difference is a 10-year risk. So if it's from 7.5 to 10%, so it's not above 10%, but it's 7.5 to 10%, you can selectively offer a statin. That's a grade C recommendation. So consider it. All right, so next we have our folks that are above 75, so age 76 and beyond. Unfortunately, there's just not enough evidence to recommend for or against starting. So basically, with certain conditions, you may want to consider may be able to do that. But then we can go into the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association recommendations that are a little bit more specific. Okay, so we have our ACC, AHA, secondary prevention guidelines. So we say if they're below 75, you're going to put them on a high intensity statin and aim for that 50% or greater LDL-C reduction. So basically, if they've got a lot of life left years, generally kind of the understanding is like 10 years or more, age less than 75, put them on a high intensity statin. And then if they're over 75, you can put them on a moderate or high intensity statin. Both are reasonable. If already on a high intensity and they're doing okay, you can just continue it. But this is kind of one of the scenarios. If you have any issues, you can decrease the dosage. So next, severe hypercholesterolemia. So let's say our LDL levels are high, like above 190, and then they're age 20 to 75. So it's a little bit lower age range. So basically, this is many adults age 20 to 75. Put them on a high intensity statin, especially be 20 because they have so many life years left. So if you have like, a 30-year-old, 40-year-old, and their LDL is 200, they could really benefit from a high intensity statin. Next, we have diabetes, kind of more as a primary prevention. So age 40 to 75, start at least a moderate intensity statin here, and consider high intensity if multiple risk factors are going on between ages 50 and 75. Next, we have patients without diabetes. LDL is less than 190. And you can kind of look at risk factors here. It's a little more nuanced. Maybe just kind of more an understanding, not a memorization. But basically, if they're low risk, just continue with lifestyle, no statin. If they're a little bit borderline, like 5% to 7.5% risk, you can consider maybe a moderate intensity statin, especially if they have conditions like ASCVD, CKD, metabolic syndrome, a high LPA. Next, we have the kind of intermediate categories, 7.5 to less than 20%. Start maybe a moderate intensity statin, and then consider a high intensity if multiple risk enhancers or if things like their coronary artery calcium score are high, you can consider it. Next, if they're high risk, greater than 20%, start a high intensity statin. So basically, just kind of generally at this point, there are guidelines you can look at them. But basically, if they have many life years left and they have many risk factors, use a high intensity. And then if they have less life years or a little bit lower risk, you can use a moderate intensity statin. So what are some contraindications to statins? So we could potentially have pregnancy. Generally, it's recommended to stop when pregnancy is planned or detected. This used to be class X, but has since been retracted, and now it's generally avoided in most situations. So another issue could potentially be breastfeeding. This generally should be avoided since it can enter the milk. One other contraindication could be active liver disease or a history of statin-associated myopathy. You could also consider using a lower effective dose, alternate statins. Some of them are potentially less problematic. And then you can also monitor the creatine kinase if symptomatic, and then any potentially hypersensitivity. So overall, though, why are these first-line drugs? These are first-line drugs because many studies have shown a reduction in morbidity and mortality in those with atherosclerotic coronary vascular disease and those at risk for ASCVD. So if you have both primary and prevention in mind, these are kind of your go-to drugs. So next, we have some of the second-line lipid-lowering agents. First, we have bile acid resins. Do you know how these work? So basically, they're going to work as an ion exchange resin by binding bile acids in the intestine. I like to think of this as kind of similar to oatmeal. On the package, some of them will say it will reduce cholesterol. There's a little heart. I just grew up reading that. I was like, what do they mean by that? But basically, the idea behind that is that some of the soluble fibers, such as beta glucans, will bind bile acids. And so these bile acids, they can contain cholesterol. And basically, when you bind them up, you're going to keep them from getting reabsorbed in distal ileum. So in turn, more bile acid is produced, more cholesterol is used, since it's a precursor for bile acids. The LDL receptors will also be promoted, and this can further reduce the circulating LDL. So basically, what it's going to do is it's going to decrease the free LDL circulating, which is what you're looking for. It's going to slightly increase HDL and slightly increase your triglycerides. So another thing to keep in mind, though, is these can actually bind other medications. So those may need to be taken separately. I think if it's just a resin binding things up. And then interestingly, when bile acid resins are combined with statins, these can have an additive effect and maybe a stronger effect than you would see with statins alone. The next medication, ezetimibe, can do that as well. So, ezetimibe is another second-line lipid-lowering agent, and it's going to work by selectively inhibiting cholesterol reabsorption at the enterocyte brush border. I like to remember this one is not easy to remember because the NPC1L1 is a specific cholesterol transporter that facilitates cholesterol reabsorption. So again, EZ, it's kind of the acronym for NPC1L1. The name of that's really not important, but just remember it's like the Niemann pick. Okay, so next we have fibrates such as gemfibrozil, fenofibrate, and these are PPAR alpha agonists. So PPAR alpha is peroxisome proliferator activated receptor alpha and is a type of nuclear receptor that acts as a transcription factor. So it's activating it. It's going to be a very slow response because it's a transcription factor. But what it's going to do is it's going to increase its lipoprotein lipase expression. So remember what that's going to do is kind of help break things down. It's going to enhance hydrolysis of circulating triglycerides into free fatty acids. The free fatty acids can then be taken up by the adipose tissue, reducing your serum triglyceride levels. So fibrates are for triglycerides. Remember that. That is important. Fibrates are for triglycerides. It's also going to increase your HDL synthesis a little bit. PPAR alpha activation also promotes expression of apolipoproteins like ApoA1, ApoA2, and this can help HDL form. So it's kind of a twofer. But the big one is basically it is going to reduce your serum triglycerides. So potential adverse effects of this, kind of similar to statins, actually could be worse if you combine it with statins, is myopathy. But the preferred one in this case would be fenofibrate, avoid gemfibrozil. So there's a preferred agent there, fenofibrate. And then the possible pathophys behind this is CYP450 metabolism could increase the statin levels, which you may see more increased effective. Another potential issue could be cholelithiasis or gallstones. So fibrates will also inhibit cholesterol cell 7-alpha hydroxylase, and this will decrease bile acid synthesis. And with the decreased bile acid synthesis, bile is going to become super saturated with cholesterol. And so, they're just going to sit there and it's going to increase your gallstone risk. Some other odds and ends: dyspepsia, elevated liver enzymes, mild transient reductions in hemoglobin, hematocrit, and white blood cell counts. Okay, so next we have niacin, also known as vitamin B3. So the way that niacin is going to work is going to inhibit lipolysis in adipose tissue. So again, it's going to start or prevent the breakdown of your already stored triglycerides, already stored compounds, and prevent them from going into circulation. So it's going to do that by blocking hormone-sensitive lipase, and then that's going to lead to decreased release of free fatty acids into the blood. You're also going to have less free fatty acids going to the liver, which means you have reduced hepatic VLDL synthesis. With reduced VLDL, you're going to have decreased LDL. And so you can see why that might be helpful. However, it sounds like in theory, it's really not clinically used as much, though. There have been several trials that have showed that it's not as helpful as far as like actual end outcomes like mortality and some of the other more important ones. So it looks good on paper, it reduces LDL, but this is like really known for increasing HDL. It's kind of one of the more unique ones where it'll increase it a little bit more. And so that was what it used to be used for. It also was used for hypertriglyceridemia. But what's probably more important to know is some of the adverse effects. These are probably the higher yield points for exams because they're unique. So first is you can get some skin changes. Do you know what they might be? Okay, so you're going to get flushing and pruritus. So that's due to the prostaglandin-mediated vasodilation, and it's preventable. Do you know how? Because if they're getting this, you can actually prevent it. So basically, you can use aspirin or ibuprofen pre-treatment. Just do it like, 20, 30 minutes before, and you won't have all this flushing. Next, you could have issues with your blood sugar. So be careful with your diabetic patients. This could cause hyperglycemia, could also cause hyperuricemia, which could be an issue for gout due to decreased renal uric acid excretion. Additionally, you could, with the niacin, you could also potentially have some GI upset like nausea, abdominal pain, diarrhea, and potentially a little hepatotoxicity. Okay, so next class, PCSK9 inhibitors. These are kind of the new kid on the block, and they are a monoclonal antibody against free PCSK9, which is the enzyme that degrades hepatic LDL receptors. So I'm going to give you a moment to think about that. There's an enzyme that degrades hepatic LDL receptors. Okay, so basically, if you were to inhibit that, would you get more or less LDL? You would get less LDL since more LDL is taken up into the liver. And basically, you're just going to have more and more receptors. And so that's really important. So if you were to use a PCSK9 inhibitor, it could potentially be called like a Kumab, Ilaricumab, Evolocumab. No guarantees I pronounce those right. But the interesting thing about this, though, is it's going to be taken a little bit differently. Since it's a monoclonal antibody, how do you think this would be taken? Its frequency is going to be quite different as well. So it's an injection. And these might be taken like weeks apart, months apart, instead of daily. So next, we have omega-3s. And basically, these ones are going to actually help lower triglycerides. And the way they do that is they're going to decrease hepatic VLDL triglyceride synthesis. So it's going to decrease that kind of de novo lipogenesis. It's going to increase beta oxidation, remember, which is the breakdown of these fats. And then it's going to increase the LPL-mediated clearance of triglyceride-rich particles. So basically, it's kind of breaking them down. So not all omega-3s are created equal, though. If you have like an EPA plus DHA combo, it'll help lower triglycerides. But it might increase LDL a little bit. If you have only an EPA, it'll lower the triglycerides without raising LDL. So that's probably not high yield for your exam. So just understand that basically the fats, the compounds, they can have different effects. So not only that, but you also need different dosages. And so, like generally, to lower triglycerides, you're going to need like a pretty large dose, like 4 grams a day, for meaningful triglyceride reduction. And so, while like fish is good for preventative measures, it may not lower triglycerides. So yeah, that is it for omega-3s. Kind of moving on, great segue into essential fatty acids, which omega-3s are. Do you know what they are and why they're essential? Okay, so essential fatty acids are polyunsaturated fatty acids that cannot be created endogenously. So we've got to consume them from our diet to be able to make certain compounds. So first, we'll cover linoleic acid. Probably names are a little bit less important, but just conceptually, it's an omega-6, 18 carbon, two double bonds. Your body turns it into arachidonic acid that you probably should recognize. Do you know why? Do you know what they turn into? So it'll be the starting material for prostaglandins, thromboxanes, leukotrienes. It's like the eicosanoid family that runs inflammation and platelet stickiness. And so it's kind of a strong backbone. And so you're going to get this from your diet. It's got to be from your diet. And you're going to get it from like things like seeds, nuts, vegetable oils, like sunflower, safflower, soybean, and corn. And then next, we have our omega-3s. These are kind of like the cousin, and they have three double bonds. So there are different sources. So there are plant sources, which will have kind of like a precursor, and they can get basically elongated into like EPA and DHA. These are the ones like directly from like fish, and these are kind of the anti-inflammatory cardioprotective compounds. Good sources of these include like cold water fish, salmon, sardines. And then plant options include things like flax or chia seeds to give you that precursor. Unfortunately, it's a pretty small amount that'll be converted. It's like in the single digits. I think I've read like 7%. So theoretically, you could have a deficiency in this little clinical pearl here. If you were, do you know how it would look or why it would come up? So you might see it. It might be like a scaly dermatitis, poor wound healing. And then it might be in newborns on basically like a fat-free, like total parenteral nutrition. Basically where they're getting like all of their nutrition from one source. And if it doesn't have this, it could be problematic. So little way to remember these, like kind of the sources, is six for seeds. You get your omega-6s from seeds, and then three for sea. So because the three omega-3s come from like fish. Again, the sixes are kind of for the arachidonic acid, eicosanoids, and then the others are kind of more cardioprotective. So we do have some other types of fats as well. Saturated fats, chemically, saturated fats contain no double bonds in their fatty acid chains. And basically, they're just kind of like, I think of like bricks almost. Like they're very uniform, linear. They're very recognizable, and they're going to pack tightly. So they're going to basically, when they are on top of each other, when they're aggregated together, they're going to become solids. And so think like butter, beef tallow, coconut oil. Basically, they're just going to sit nice and they're not going to move. So diets high in saturated fats, unfortunately, have also been associated with increased LDL cholesterol, partly due to reduced LDL receptor activity in the liver, which decreases LDL clearance from the blood. So they're kind of sticky and they'll kind of block up LDL clearance from the blood. So next we have trans fats. They do have double bonds, kind of like the unsaturated fats, but they're in a trans configuration. So chemically, they're going to straighten out. They're going to almost physically behave more like a saturated fat. And so, food industry likes it because they're solid at room temperature. They work well, but then they can also make them from oils. And so the problem, though, is these are particularly harmful. Like gram for gram, they're more strongly associated with increasing LDL and lowering HDL than any of the others. And so for that reason, the FDA banned them back in 2018 from added foods. Technically, there is some naturally occurring, but it seems like maybe they're a little bit less damaging. So kind of the takeaway though from all of these though, in practice is more about the generally heart healthy diets. Basically these are all going to be part of things like the DASH and Mediterranean diet, probably more of those like PUFAs, the polyunsaturated fatty acids. And they're going to focus generally less on the amount of total fats. Total fat could be a factor, but basically they're going to basically try to replace the saturated and trans fats from things like butter, red meat, processed foods, with unsaturated fats found in like liquid plant oils, nuts, seeds, fatty fish. And then basically for patients with elevated lipids, these swaps can help lower LDL and improve overall cardiovascular risk. But it's not just that too. Don't forget about things like DASH diet. This is also great for blood pressure in addition to lipids. It is named a dietary approach to stop hypertension. And so for a patient with like a normal BMI, this would be your go-to for blood pressure reduction. And then in those with a higher BMI above like 25, weight loss itself might be like your number one thing to do because it's going to have a larger impact in reducing blood pressure. All right. So that was a lot. Let's do kind of a conclusion, brief recap of the high yield points for repetition. So for our familial dyslipidemias, do you remember which ones are autosomal dominant? So 2 and 4, you'll see more in the family. 1 and 3, leave them be as they're autosomal recessive. Do you remember which types are associated with pancreatitis? Okay, so types of 1 and 4, the ends, the first and the last, are associated with pancreatitis, while 2 and 3, the ones in the inner, think about like inner of the arteries, are associated with premature atherosclerosis. Okay, so next we have our drugs. We have our statins, HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors, and these are generally used in a moderate or high-intensity statin fashion. So next we have bile acid resins. These are going to act like beta-glucans, kind of like in the oatmeal, by binding cholesterol within the GI tract. After that, we have ezetimibe, and it's going to block cholesterol absorption at the level of the enterocyte. Again, not easy to remember because it's a silly Niemann-Pick cholesterol absorption point. And then after that, we have niacin. This one's going to block hormone-sensitive lipase, again, kind of reducing the peripheral breakdown of the adipose and increasing or basically allowing it to go into the bloodstream. And that's thus going to decrease our hepatic VLDL secretion. But it's not often used. I probably wouldn't pick this on an answer choice on an exam unless it was something, some specific symptom or something, but it's not really going to be your go-to. Next, we have PCSK9 inhibitors. These are monoclonal antibodies that bind PCSK9 to stop the breakdown of LDL receptors. And these are going to be given in injection and a longer period. Next, we have fish oil and omega-3s. These are going to lower triglycerides by hepatic VLDL production and increasing clearance. And so last, just for a little bonus, this is not likely to be on your exam, but you may see it in clinical practice. There is recently in 2020 been approved bempedoic acid, and it's basically going to be kind of an inhibitor upstream of the statin pathway. And so it can be used in certain situations where the others aren't working. But yeah, again, this is just kind of an emerging therapy, so just keep it on your radar. To kind of cut back to our opening vignette of the STEMI, we know that chronically high LDL and triglycerides deposit in coronary artery walls, forming cholesterol-rich atherosclerotic plaques, while a low HDL level leaves the arteries without their cholesterol cleanup molecule. Over time, these plaques become inflamed, unstable, and when one ruptures, platelets and fibrin can create an acute thrombus that will lead to an abrupt occlusion of the artery. The resulting ischemia of downstream myocardium and pain is what we recognize as a type 1 myocardial infarction. With ST elevations in V2 to V5, this localizes to an anterior LAD STEMI. In this case, a statin could have played a role in preventing the MI, but even post-MI, statins can help reduce recurrence and risk by stabilizing the vulnerable plaques to prevent future events. So, in closing, thank you for listening. If you found this episode helpful today, please take a moment to consider subscribing to our podcast. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, please visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org and post them under the link for this episode. Good luck with your studying, and remember that if you ever have an SOS moment while studying, Spoonful of Sugar is always there to help the medicine go down.